Sunday Morning's Thoroughbred Magazine. For the next hour, we're talking horses. Here's Joe McKinnon.
Good morning, everyone. Great to have your company for Talking Horses this week. Firstly, sad news yesterday with the passing of broadcaster Drew Morfitt. Drew was a top bloke and a brilliant broadcaster, and he was so passionate about horse racing as a punter, owner and breeder, and with his wife Kaz ran a very successful horse spelling property in Victoria. Often, Drew was at a racetrack somewhere, and as many of you would attest, it was always a great pleasure to run into him. He was one of those rare people who could light up any company he was in, always happy, funny and passionate. To his family and many friends in the media and racing industries, condolences. He will be greatly missed and always fondly remembered. On this week's show, we'll catch up with an extraordinary young man, Ed Fernan. He won the recent Mongol Derby, the world's toughest horse race. His story is well worth hearing and will be sure to inspire you. Also, our regular Horse Bites segment with Adam Sangster. But first, Inglis hosted its August sale on Friday, and Simon Vivian joins us to reflect on the great results. Inglis hosted a highly successful August sale on Friday. Simon Vivian from the company joining us on Talking Horses as our first guest this morning. How are you, Simon?
Good morning, Joe. I am very well, and I hope you are as well, and all of you listening.
Well, another successful sale for Inglis. Is this the most successful August sale that's ever been staged?
Joe, to my record, yes, it has been. I think that's the first time we've ever been able to achieve an August sale that has seen trade in excess of $3 million. I think that this sale has always been a very interesting sale. Obviously, it's been predominantly a one-day sale right on the doorstep of the breeding season. So fillies that are coming off the track and good pedigree broodmares have always been in great demand, but it's also been a wonderful sale for the purposes of people buying racehorses. But all of that said, I think that it was an absolutely extraordinary day that we had yesterday, and I think some of the results were quite fantastic, to be honest.
What were some of the major highlights from your perspective?
I suppose, Joe, the most important thing with any of these sorts of sales is to try and get your clearance rate up very high. So we had a very, very good clearance rate. We had an average price for all of the lots going through, where we would normally probably budget for around about a $10,000 or $11,000 average, we averaged just under $18,000, which was fantastic. So that generated a gross sale of in excess of $3.1 million, a top price of $150,000 for a mare by the name of Condolences, a Street Cry half-sister to the Cox Plate winner in Maldivian, made $150,000. But in addition to that, Joe, it was as much about the competition on all of the horses. We had phenomenal support for this sale from Godolphin, who put in a large number of race horses. And speaking with Jess Bryan through the offering of the Godolphin horses, I know that she and her team of management in Sydney were delighted with the results. So, look, you know, with Godolphin's support, Swetnam put in some great broodmares and great support. Obviously, we had the Greendale Trust of the late Michael Nile to offer a number of horses. Combining that with all of the other horses that we had in the sale, it was just one of those sort of days where there was so much active bidding. It was fantastic.
Mm. And the Michael Nile Trust horses did sell well, not surprisingly.
Very pleased for the estate that we were able to get the result we got. These horses had come from a number of farms around the country, and look, it's very, very sad to lose a gentleman and a great breeder like Michael Nile. He's been a fabulous supporter of the Victorian thoroughbred industry and the national industry as well. But look, it was fortunate from our viewpoint that his solicitors decided to use the services of Inglis to disperse his bloodstock at this point. And as a result of that, it generated a great deal of interest. We had agents from right around. We had obviously very strong representation from Belmont Bloodstock, who were there and bought the top price lot. But in addition to that, we had people like Julian Blaxland and Dave Mee from New South Wales. We also had Neil Jenkinson down from Queensland. So what it was that it was one of those sales, Joe, that created a massive amount of interest. Probably one of the interesting things about the sale was that we endeavoured to try and get the sale completed by between 5 and 5.30, and it actually, we drew overtime and didn't complete the sale until after 6 o'clock. But the reason for that was, quite frankly, because of the volume of bidding that existed on so many of the lots in the sale that horses probably spent a little more time in the ring than you would normally allow them. But if there's bidding going, we'll keep going.
Caps off a busy week for you, Simon. I see you were front and centre at the Swettenham Open Day last weekend.
Yes, it was great. It was a fabulous Sunday because we started the day at Woodside Park where Woodside Park presented to the public their new stadium, Cable Bay, for the first time, and a great crowd in attendance at Woodside Park. And then just down the road at Adam Sankster's beautiful property at Swettenham, we got an opportunity to see the two freshman horses in Mshawish and also Rebel Dane, as well as the other great horses that are already located at Swettenham. So it was a terrific day, and it's fascinating to see the number of people that take advantage of going to these studs on these open days, Joe, to have a look at these stallions. It's quite interesting when you go there and see how different they are. When you look at a horse like Toronado and compare him to Rebel Dane, and then you compare him to Trust and August, and then you compare him to Mshawish. They're so different, and it's very, very important for broodmare owners to go and have a look at the horses and find a stallion that complements their mares physically as well as on pedigree.
Simon, thanks for joining us on Talking Horses.
Great to speak to you, Joe. All the best.
Simon Vivian from Inglis. Stakes racing returned to Moonee Valley yesterday with the listed Mackenzie Stakes and the Carlion Stakes. The Mackenzie Stakes, over 1,200 metres for three-year-olds, was won by the I Am Invincible colt Overshare from Team Hawks. He's out of a Redoute's Choice mare, Savannah's Choice. He was sold at the 2016 Inglis Australian Easter Yearling Sale for $320,000. Bandipur was second home in the Mackenzie. He's a colt by Commands out of a Viscount mare, Patamata. And Sunquest was the third place getter, a colt by Helmet out of the Seeking the Gold mare, Seeking Sunshine. The listed Carline Stakes over 1,000 metres went the way of Miss Rock, trained by Robbie Lang. She's a four-year-old mare by Fastnet Rock out of the strategic mare Miss Judgment, sold at the 2015 Magic Millions Gold Coast Yearling Sale for $500,000. Some of her winning siblings include Cartier Rock, City of Justice and Power Supply. Second in the race, Heatherly from the Ellerton Zara team, a lovely five-year-old mare by Lonro out of the Danziro mare Dancing Heather. She went through the 2014 Inglis Australian Easter Yearling Sale. And Lady Esprit was third home in the Carline. She's trained by Kieran Ma, a five-year-old daughter of Bella Spree out of the Bellotto mare Fanciful Bella, not offered at the Yearling Sales. Three feature races at Rosehill Gardens in Sydney yesterday. The first of those was the listed Premier's Cup over 1,900 metres, won by the Gaywaterhouse and Adrian Bott-trained DIC, a six-year-old gelding by Isterdard out of the Night Shift mare Smashed All Night. Classic Uniform ran second. He's a five-year-old son of Al Maher out of the Canny Ladmare Pyrotechnics. And Peter Roble's Centre Pivot was third, a son of More Than Ready, now 7 years old, out of his Abiel mare, Waterwise. The Group 3 Ming Dynasty was won by Bjorn Baker's Addictive Nature, a three-year-old colt by Savabiel out of a Carnegie mare, Generous Nature. This horse was sold through the 2016 New Zealand Bloodstock Premier Yearling Sale for $775,000. Winning siblings include Savvy Nature and Sir Ferrari. Paul and Peter Snowden's Assimilate ran second, a three-year-old colt by Sebring out of the Commands mare Jester's Girl, and James Cummings' Astoria, a three-year-old son of Medaglia d'Oro, was third. He's out of an Ad Valorem mare, Segu. Race 7, the Group 3 San Domenico Stakes run over 1,100 metres, and Pariah bounced back to the winner's circle, a very smart three-year-old colt by Redoute's Choice out of the Hussanay mare Secluded. He was sold through the 2016 Inglis Australian Easter Yearling Sale for $700,000. Chauffeur was second. He's a colt by Snitzel out of the De Heer mare Mirror Mirror. And third went to Jorda from the Godolphin team, a daughter of Exceed and Excel out of a Viscount mare, Montmello. Loads of horses to follow out of the San Domenico in Sydney yesterday, namely Pariah. He'll go on to do some pretty special things.
On Talking Horses, welcome to Horse Bites.
Good morning, Adam. How are things?
Good morning, Joe. Things are pretty good. Pretty frosty here, I've got to say, on this Sunday morning. I've just come up from South Melbourne Market with going to Edward at the Dimmy's counter there and just taking up a couple of, well, 100 of them up to another further Sweat and Stallion Day we have. It's a quieter one, but we've got a few people coming at midday today.
How did your opening day go last weekend?
Do you know what? It was a great success. We were blessed with the weather. I mean, we really were. Either side of it was horrendous, but Sunday was glorious. And they, you know, they went up to Woodside to start off with, and then they poured through the gate with me, and we had a glorious time. And then everybody hopped across to Mitchelton for the Festival of Chocolate, which was fantastic. So it was. You even had sort of James Hurd sort of showpiecing his chocolate entity as well. So there was a lot to add there, but we. You know, we had a really good day there. So it was at the Stallion Parade, and a lot of good clients came around, and the Stallions paraded magnificently, and as did the foals, which we had a couple, and we've had a few more since. No, it was a good day, Joe.
And you also paraded some of the mares that went through Friday's sale at Inglis for the Michael Nile Greendale Estate.
Yeah, we did. It was interesting because what we did, we had our digital man Tim Patterson come up and he filmed it and managed to get out the footage very quickly onto all social media's sort of ranks. So we had an amazing amount of sort of views on Facebook, and I've got to say, leading into this season, I've been sort of very proactive in contacting an enormous amount of sort of certainly the Victorian trainers, the South Australian trainers, the sort of Riverina area, and of course the Tasmanian trainers as well, trying to instigate them to sort of breed to someone like Trust and the Gus, who were doing very good deals on second season. And he paraded magnificently himself, and people are in awe of him because he has strengthened up beautiful. It's actually quite pleasing to see that just when people click through on the SMSs, we've had over 500 clicks there, over 3,500 on Facebook. And it's gone pretty well, and that I think instigated a lot of sort of talk about the sale, which happened yesterday. And Inglises were particularly happy about the strength of it. There was a very good turnout from breeders, and that just shows that sort of an August thoroughbred sale, has got a position in the market for sure. A lot of these mares were in foals to good stallions, and people came for the Trust in the Gust, as I say, but also they came for our Toronado. We sold some nice ones then, especially for the estate of the late Michael Nile. And it was well documented, but also very well executed by all concerned. So we were pretty happy with it, Joe.
Well, hopefully those horses have found their way into good hands, and his legacy will live on in some way, shape, or form.
That's right, and there are a couple of mares which we didn't take down to the sale because they're so close to foaling, and they're both in Costa del Lago mares. One's the mare who's fourth in the Tasmanian Oaks, and one is Quinta del Lago. They're good mares, and they can be purchased. They'll be foaling any day now, but we're pretty happy with that, Joe.
And touching back on your point about digital media and the execution of that promotional campaign, so immediately after the open day, it's the way of the future, isn't it? Many people can't get to these days, so it's a great way of taking them there.
It is, but you've got to feed the beast. When I say that, you've got to really reach out and really work on it and make sure that people, you present it in front of them, because we've all got such busy lives at the moment, and to try and look at everything, because there's so much information out there, but you've got to present it in the right. light format, not too lengthy, and a bit punchy, and also a little bit quirky as well. So certainly our production man, Tim Patterson, did a very good job, and it was well executed by all our team in the administration office at Sweatham. So we're pretty good. And we're also having, we've got another show, another parade happening after Godolphin on the 3rd, Sunday the 3rd, Barber's Day. So Shane Anderson is presenting there for us, and so we all I welcome any of your listeners to come up and have a look at the stallions there, because it's exciting times for us, Joe.
Terrific, Adam. Busy times for you. Well done on the open day last weekend, and good luck for this afternoon as well. I hope it's another enjoyable afternoon for everybody involved.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you to your listeners.
Adam Sangster joining us for Horse Bites this week on Talking Horses.
Swettenham Stud contributed to the production costs of this report.
RSN 927's Talking Horses with Joe McKinnon.
Last week, London 2012 Olympian Ed Fernan has added winning the grueling Mongol Derby to his impressive list of achievements. Fernan, aged 29, crossed the finish line with South African Barry Armitage in equal first, setting what is a new world record for the fastest time to complete the race. Fernan finished in 7 days, smashing the previous world record of 10 days, and he's our special guest on Talking Horses this week. Good morning, Ed.
G'day, Joe. How are you?
I'm very well. More importantly, how are you recovering after such an arduous journey?
I'm not too bad at the moment. I was certainly feeling it during the race, but we had a great opportunity to have a relax at the end, so I was able to get a bit of rest and recuperation, and in many ways, I feel very thankful because I turned out a lot better than some of the many people who had to withdraw during the race with many of the injuries. So I'm pretty lucky, I think.
As background for our listeners, Ed, the Mongolian Derby featured in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's longest and toughest race. It's a 1,000-kilometre trek through the rugged terrain of the Mongolian steppes. It's the toughest horse race in the world and recreates Chinggis Khan's legendary empire-busting postal system. Riders change horses every 40 kilometres and stay with the local herders or camp under the stars. What an incredible experience this must have been for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It was truly amazing. You talked about staying with the local herders. I think that was one of my highlights. Prior to the race, I got one of the translators to write a little message to the herders saying, "Hello, my name is Edward Fernan. I'm competing in the Mongol Derby. Can I stay with you tonight? Can you look after my horse?" And, you know, we've got to finish each evening. We've got to stop riding at 8:30. They don't permit us to ride during the dark. And for me, I turned up at this local Mongolian family. They had no idea who I was or what I was doing, and I gave this little slip, and they sort of read it confused, and then they invited me into their gur. I sort of slept in their gur, which is just a small, tiny tent with their family. There was six of us in a tiny, tiny room, and they gave me food and looked after my horses, and it was just a really amazing, authentic experience that I'll remember for the rest of my life.
What did the evening meal consist of?
The evening meal was fermented horse milk, which is the Airag, which I wasn't a big fan of, just quietly. and we had horse yogurt and mutton. They gave us a big sort of leg of mutton that we took me about 5 minutes to be able to get it off the bone, but was successful in the end.
Tough as old leather boot soles, I gather.
yeah, very, very tough, very, very tough. So it was fantastic and great. So it was just an interesting time, and very different to being in Australia. My father-in-law and my wife's family have a Garama Pole Dorset stud, which is a great sheep stud in down towards Boorowa, and so we're used to eating a lot of good meat, so it was certainly very different to that.
And to be accommodated so intimately with a family you don't even know, I imagine they didn't speak any English either. It must have been awkward at times.
Yeah, you can't really communicate, but at the same time, they talk in Mongolian and I was talking in English and we sort of got along. next morning, he actually came out and helped me. He helped me put the saddle on the horse and helped me leave it the next morning at 7 o'clock. And I had a bit of a chuckle when I went over to my saddle and he put my stirrups up four holes. And then I went over and put them down. And then he was like, no, up, like up, 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 like pointing up. Just thinking that because I was racing, that I had to have the high stirrups and get going. But I guess he wasn't doing the long race, because anyone in endurance riding knows if you ride in really high stirrups, your knees get an absolute workover. So that was a bit funny.
When you're covering 40 kilometres a day compared to, say, 1,000, 1,200 metres or 2,000 metres of a normal horse race, riding short would not be advisable.
No, absolutely not.
And the horses that you use. Now, explain to our listeners how you procure those horses.
So there's 1,400 horses that are provided, and they're provided for from the local herders. So across the trip, there's each herder family comes in and they provide the horses. So these are semi-wild horses. There's no fences in Mongolia. They live just out on the steppe, and then the herders catch them mostly in the summertime. So during winter, minus 20, minus 40, up to minus 40 degrees Celsius, the horses are in the snow sort of trying to find and dig for food. So they're very, very hardy horses, and then the herders just bring them in. So a lot of these haven't been ridden in some time. Probably I'd say every second horse I got on needed some serious assistance with. So probably take two of them to put a bridle on, a couple of them to put a saddle on, and then would just buck for 5 to 10 minutes before you could sort of settle it down, and then away you went, and then you were right. I always found it good to try and gallop it out a little bit and try and get it moving forward to save myself time.
So they're virtually unbroken wild horses that you've got to suddenly build a rapport with and ride for an entire day.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other big thing, which I think for a lot of people created an issue, was the marmot holes. So there's sort of like the wombat or rabbit holes in Australia, and so you're galloping flat chat and there's all these holes that the horses are pretty good at dodging, but still a lot of people went down those holes and suffered some pretty serious injuries. I was given some fantastic advice very early on that whatever you do, don't touch the horse's mouth. Just let it run, let it gallop if it wants to gallop, because at the moment you start, you know, pulling on its head, trying to control the horse too much, then that's the time when it stops focusing on the marmot holes and you run into a bit of trouble. So lucky I didn't go down any of them.
Gee whiz. I mean, there are so many challenges attached to this race. It's quite extraordinary. Whatever prompted you to want to take this on?
Well, yeah, I think everyone who competes in this race is a little bit unhinged, and I'd have to put myself into that category, especially after competing it. But for me, I think I went to the London Olympic Games and competed for a long period of time. And after I retired from modern pentathlon, I just still wanted to compete, put myself in uncomfortable situations and try and push myself to the limit, something that I sort of got out of competition. So I've since then was looking for regular challenges or ways to test myself. Last year I went and climbed Aconcagua, which is the highest mountain in the Southern Hemisphere. And then this year I just thought, take on the Mongol Derby, which I think I always try and look for challenges that stretch me and things that get me really excited, and this absolutely did that. I was tremendously excited to go over there. I wasn't necessarily going to try and win. That wasn't really in the forefront of my mind. I was just more going over with the objective of doing my best and just trying to push myself to the limit and just come home safe, which I was lucky to do, most importantly.
Because a lot of people don't.
Yeah, absolutely. This year was actually probably the best year where most people got through it. But I know in 2012, five people broke bones in the first kilometre of the race in the sort of sprint start that normally happens. This year, only nine withdrew from the race with injuries. But many people who did complete the course, in particular one of the UK competitors, he had a bad fall on one of the days and broke his ribs and then continued on. So some of the other people and my fellow competitors, I was really inspired by their persistence and determination to just get through and complete it.
So this is much more than just a nice country hack in the Mongolian countryside, isn't it? As it appears in all the imagery, the beautiful imagery that we see.
Yeah, definitely. It's a real test, not only of horsemanship, and you know, you've got to be able to ride, there's no doubt about that, and be able to deal with the horses, but navigation as well. You're following a line and being able to follow the route. One stage I went the wrong way, and I was on the complete opposite side of the valley, and I had to go over this huge mountain pass that not only took a long time, but it was just really, really tough on myself and the horses. So that's a big part of it. But also camping out as a survival skill. I camped out on one night. I stayed with the family. And so to go those, to deal with that, as well as not eating. So you start at 7 o'clock in the morning and 8:30 you've got to finish each night. So for me, a big part of that and where I was able to save a lot of time was I just wouldn't stop to eat. I would try and grab what I could at the different horse stations, and maybe that would be like a piece of bread that I'd put in my pocket. But during those hours, I wasn't stopping to have a meal. I was just trying to push it and get as much riding done during the day as I could.
Having prepared for pentathlon at Olympic level, you know too well how to get yourself fit. For this particular challenge, how did you prepare in the lead-up?
Well, that's actually a really good question, because I probably didn't have the most ideal preparation that I would have liked. My horses are in Geelong, down near Harden, New South Wales, and I was working in Sydney, so I didn't have a huge amount of time to do a lot of riding. I tried to get down there on weekends, and I'd do the odd endurance race, did a couple of endurance races, and that was really helpful and great. But I think for me, it was more the mindset of I've got to get back to the fitness that I had when I was competing full time. So I just did a lot of running, got back into the running quite seriously, which was really enjoyable. Since retirement, I sort of backed off a lot of that training. So to get my mindset back and to have that goal and that vision of, especially knowing where I had to be, and getting supremely fit again was a great part of the process and a part of the journey. So I think for more importantly, it was just getting myself mentally prepared, as well as running, getting fit, going back and doing a lot of the physio work and strength and conditioning work that I knew I needed to make sure that my body was in the best state possible. So when I went over there, I knew I'd just bury myself and it'd be all over in sort of 7 to 10 days.
And so all that hard work paid off. You were equal first with the South African rider, Barry Armitage. Explain to us what happens at the finish of the race and how victory is immediately celebrated.
Yeah, well, a big part of the race is making sure that the horses get through the vet check. So horse welfare in this race is very, very important. Needed to make sure that at the end of each leg, within half an hour, horses' heart rate's coming down to under 56, or 56 or under, I might say, as well as making sure it's not lame, making sure the gut sounds are fine. So that is a huge consideration for all the riders. So Barry and I raced out of the last checkpoint in front, and then Barry had caught me on one of the horses, and then with a couple of kilometres out, we knew we had to bring the horse's heart rate down because we didn't want to get a two-hour vet penalty. So that's when we decided to back off together, and so it wasn't worth the risk, and hence why we crossed the finish line together. But But I think horse welfare is vital in this race, especially when we're borrowing horses from the local Mongolian herders. We need to make sure that for the future of the race and for the herders and also the horses, that it can continue. And we do that by making sure that they are looked after.
So the rules of engagement are very much based around endurance?
Yes, they are. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But the horses are doing that 40 kilometre, 35 to 40 kilometre legs in each one. So we rode a total of 27 horses during the race. And whoever's first into each station gets to pick their next horse first, which is a large advantage in many of the stations.
So what attributes do you look for in the confirmation of a Mongolian pony?
Well, it was amazing. I thought I was going over there and they literally were all tiny, small little ponies, but there were a lot of the bigger horses and they came in all shapes and sizes and they were put on the line, so they have these almost like a big clothesline and all the horses are attached to the line and you walk along and you've got to choose your horse. I must say that I still don't think I've got it right. I still don't think I can pick the perfect horse and how to, the best way to do it. I had one of the herders and translators came up to me at the end of the race and said, "You've got a very good eye for the horse." And I sort of laughed and said, "Oh, no, no, no." He said, "No, no, every time you went into the horse station and you left, the herder said, that man's got my best horse." So, which makes me think, well, if I had his best horse, I'd hate to be getting on his worst one because some of them weren't fantastic. I think for me, what I was looking for in many cases were horses with old saddle sores so that I knew, well, they've got an old saddle sore that's not going to cause any issues riding them, but at least I know they've been ridden. And the other thing was generally fairly skittish. So in many cases, I was picking horses that were on more of the wild side, just because I know they were going to be a little bit more sensitive to riding, and so that they'd probably take off a bit if I was to put my leg on them, and which made for very interesting times when I got on the horse, but at least we got underway and we were able to get out of there.
You would have had to strap yourself in for the first couple of 100 metres, I would imagine.
Yeah, generally that was the time. Yeah, that first 20 minutes you just hung on and see, hopefully you're still hanging on at the end.
Now, your experience in doing extraordinary things on horseback extends beyond the Mongolian Derby. You spent 5 weeks years ago riding the Snowy Mountains by horseback, and you were also involved in a ride that spanned across 1,100 kilometres from Braidwood in New South Wales to Melbourne, retracing the legend of Archer. And in doing that, you raised over $50,000 for the Black Dog Institute, which researches and treats mood disorders.
Yeah, that's right. That was a great experience. Back in 2012, I wanted to raise funds for the Black Dog Institute and raise awareness of rural depression in particular. And so I wanted to come back from the Olympic Games as an Olympian to be able to go out there and raise those funds. And so we made up supposedly Archer walked to Melbourne before winning the inaugural Melbourne Cup in 1861. So we sort of retraced that legend and that journey, which started at in Braidwood and took us 3 days to ride to Canberra, and then we followed the Bicentennial National Trail all the way down to Melbourne. And that was I did that solo, but I'd have locals come in and ride with me for a couple of days, and that was a truly amazing experience to go through and ride and meet so many amazing people. And we were very successful in that pursuit to be able to raise those funds and get through it.
And amazing that Archer went on after that famous journey to win a Melbourne Cup.
Yeah. Well, they found out that Archer didn't walk the whole way to Melbourne. He walked some of the way and then caught a boat. But I think the story of Archer in itself is amazing, winning the 1861 Melbourne Cup and then backing it up in 1862 And then in 1863, there was a postal strike and his entry was late. And the Victorians weren't happy that the New South Wales horse was coming to fill their cup. So disqualified Archer. And then that was the smallest race ever held because most of the trainers withdrew their horses out of protest. And I think in 1863, they only had 7 runners in the cup. So that story in itself was a great legend, and it was great to be part of that journey and to retrace that legend.
How do you think Archer would have gone in the Mongolian Derby?
Oh, I reckon he would have gone all right. Yeah, many times I was actually naming, I never named the bad horses, but I'd always name the good ones that I got on after Melbourne Cup winners. So, I had a couple of good ones there. And on one particular day, I got on at 7:45 in the evening, so I only had 45 minutes of race time. And the horse I chose, I didn't know this at the time, but it was a very successful Mongolian sprint racer, and at 8:15, half an hour later, I was still trying to work out how I was going to pull this horse up. It just took off and would just gallop and gallop and gallop, and I just sat on it, going through this pine forest and through these valleys and over ditches, and just trying to hang on. But I managed to pull it up at 8:25, so I didn't get any time penalties there, but. That was another amazing moment, something that I'll always remember.
Where are all these horses go now? Where are they? How are they dispersed after the race? Do they go back to their owners, who are the herders? Or?
Yeah, that's right. So the herders, in many cases, travel 200 kilometres to the different stations. And so they'll come in a month before the horses will come, bring their horses in. I was talking with one of the translators who told me that one of the horses herded his horses 300 kilometres to the start line to bring them in. So they're not bringing them in by trucks, they're just bringing them to where they need to be, just herding them. But now the horses are done, they just get let out, and they're on the Mongolian steppe now, eating grass, preparing for the winter. So the story of these horses and how hardy they are is very, very different to anything I've seen or been involved with, certainly in Australia.
Well, you're pretty tough too, Ed. There's no doubt about that. And I believe you live by the win mentality, or as you describe it, what's important now. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, that was a experience I had. I did a training session with Michael Phelps in Colorado Springs at the US Olympic Training Center. And yeah, during that training session, I spoke with his coach, Bob Bowman, and obviously Michael Phelps being the greatest Olympian of all time, I was sort of trying to, hanging off every word that I could of Bob Bowman, who was Michael Phelps' coach. And I said to him, what do you think's the most important aspect of sort of training and competing? And he said to me, win. And I thought, well, yeah, of course, everyone wants to win. And no, he said, no, what's important now? And that's something that I've really tried to live by ever since that meeting, not only in competition, but just in everyday life, in terms of focusing on that moment, living in the moment and trying to focus on, well, what is important at this particular point in time. So during the race, often I would think, okay, well, what do I need to do right now that's going to help me during the race? Maybe that was preparing for a vet check, making sure the horse has got water and we're stopping at a water hole and to make sure that the horse is well hydrated, or maybe it's not eating or choosing to get water. So a lot of those things were going through my mind, and that was one of the ways that I was trying to funnel my own information and help my own decision-making process.
What was the greatest thing you learnt out of that experience in Mongolia?
I think the people you meet and the friends you make along the way are something that I'll take away forever. The Mongolian culture is truly unique. I mean, they're living quite similar to the way that Genghis Khan lived 800 years ago. Yes, there's an odd person with a car and a TV, but they still live their nomadic sort of herding lifestyle. So to be able to not only witness that, but in a small sense, live that way for a small amount of time was truly remarkable, and I'll always remember. But yeah, the contest is great, and going over there and winning is fantastic, but what's more important is sort of the journey and to go over there and to come home to knowing that I've given my all and was successful in that pursuit.
Would you do it again?
No, I won't be going back, and I've had a couple of people that have asked me to come back and sort of try and retain my title for next year, but for me, that's not really important. I was able, regardless of the result, I was able to achieve what I wanted to do, which was go over there and push myself to the limit and give it my all, and I was able to do that, and lucky enough to come away with the win. But now I'll look for the next adventure and the next challenge.
And is that next adventure likely to involve a horse?
Oh, it could well do. I've had two invitations come in over the last week to compete in different horse races around the world. One in South Africa, which is a big race, which Barry Armitage actually, who won the race with me, he's heavily involved with. So got an invitation there. So I don't know. I think most of these challenges find me rather than I find them. Just got to keep optimistic and open-minded, and I don't know where it's going to end up.
And you've also got a big business to run too. You work in property development in what little spare time you would have cramming in all these different things that you do in your life. I don't know how you fit it all in.
Yeah, that's something I need to certainly focus on now. I purchased the former Katoomba Golf Club earlier this year that went into liquidation back in 2013. So I'm now involved doing a townhouse development along the former course and just trying to bring the old clubhouse back to life with a restaurant and function centre and with very limited hospitality experience. That's been quite a challenge, but I'm not shy of getting my hands dirty and getting involved. So I hope that I can turn that around, and that'll be my new focus for the immediate term.
And you could add some uniqueness to the hospitality offering, maybe introduce horse milk to the menu.
Yeah, bring in some mutton as well and see how things go. But I don't know how well that would go. It's sort of experience it the Mongolian way, I think.
Exactly. Ed, absolutely fascinating to hear your story, and thank you so much for sharing the journey of the Mongolian Derby and not only winning it but setting a new world record for completion in just 7 days, beating the previous record of 10 days. That's quite incredible.
Thanks very much, Joe. It was certainly an amazing experience. I'm very thrilled to be now home and looking forward to that next challenge, whatever it may be.
And we look forward to seeing and hearing what that next chapter is. No doubt it will be something very interesting and exciting. That's Ed Fernan, the winner of the 2017 Mongol Derby, joining us exclusively on Talking Horses.
Across Victoria, our thoroughbred racing heartland, RSN 927 is Talking Horses.
And that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of Talking Horses. I hope you enjoyed the show. Special thanks to our guests Ed Fernan, Adam Sangster and Simon Vivian. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.